BitCo is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm Duncan McLeod. I'm in Sandton today to talk to Brandon Becker, the regional MD for a really interesting company called Mimecast. You've probably heard of Mimecast, but I'm willing to bet many people listening to this podcast don't realize that this NASDAQ-listed company, which has a market value of more than 20 billion rand, was founded by South Africans and still has strong connections to the country. Brandon, thanks so much for talking to Tech Central today.
Thank you, Duncan.
So I think let's start by looking at the history of Mimecast leading up to the listing in 2015 on the NASDAQ. It was founded by two South Africans, Peter Bauer and Neil Murray. What's the backstory?
Okay, so both Peter Bauer and Neil Murray are South African. Peter's from Cape Town. I was actually at school with him, so we go a long way back. Neil Murray from Johannesburg, and they both had success in listed IT businesses in South Africa. Peter with Fab Technologies and Neil with, I believe, a company called Glowtech.
I remember them, Global Technology. They were listed
right.
On the JSE.
That's right.
They were kind of an amalgamation of a whole lot of businesses.
Correct.
What happened to them, do you know?
I don't know actually what happened to them, but the business did... it ended up delisting, and I think they broke the business up into its various parts. But subsequent to that, Neil found himself in London, as did Peter, almost coincidentally. And they're both, into software and particularly had an interest in email and I guess how you could look at simplifying what had become quite a complex environment. So email wasn't designed to do what it does today. So email initially was designed to be a written form of communication among people, probably much like WhatsApp or text messaging is today. And then since it was such a useful platform for communication, businesses started sending confidential information, salary slips. Businesses even started trading over email. And as that became a more pervasive and mission-critical business application, you needed to ensure that that communication was safe and secure, and that that communication was up all the time, and that records of those interactions were kept. And so what happened was businesses needed to invest in point solutions to address security of email, continuity of email, and uptime of email, and storage of email. So it became a real server room nightmare with multiple servers and multiple hardware and software platforms to support this email environment. So with that, it became complex, expensive, and quite risky. So they got together and thought, how can they start addressing, the complexity of this email environment and the cost? And it was way back when, software as a service was still kind of taking, or it wasn't even taking off. It was pretty new back then. That was back in 2003. And they started building a platform. Neil is a developer. He's a coder himself. So they started building this platform in about 2003. The product in its very early stages became ready in about 2004, which coincidentally was the same time that South Africa opened for business. So the product was ready in 2004 and went to market. quite fortuitously, the product resonated very well in the legal vertical in London, which is a particularly onerous and demanding vertical. So right from the get-go, the product became really advanced early on to cater for that particular vertical. And proud to say today, I think we've got 96 of the top 100 law firms in the UK. So it's we're very dominant in that market, subsequently in South Africa, the US and Australia as well. In South Africa, we've got all the top law firms. It was a goal of ours, and probably about 3 years ago, we managed to get the last one. So I think the top 15 law firms in size are customers of ours as well. And they make for very good references because of how demanding they are. So it's quite easy to pivot into other verticals when you're providing a great service for the legal vertical. So that was, the business product, if you like, available from 2004 onwards. South African office opened about then, and we started trading. And obviously, right from the ground roots, very tough, building sales teams, trying to build a brand. Back then, software as a service was also not really mainstream or very well thought of. So it was always a very difficult conversation just to talk about cloud and to get customers to start thinking about how cloud can help them, simplify their email environment and lower the costs. But there was always a strong value proposition. I mean, if you're limiting or lowering the risk, cost, and complexity while providing a fixed, predictable cost per user per month, that did resonate. I guess it was just customers taking that leap of faith early on. So, yeah, we just continued to build the business in those two markets. Had a couple of VC investments along the way. And then I think our really big move was in 2008, January, where we set up an office in the US and decided to really double down on that market. So, if you really want to make it as a software company, you've got to be able to make it in the US. Pleased to say today we've got two large offices there, one in Boston, which for all intents is our head office, but I'll get back to that. And then also a nice large office in Dallas, which is becoming also a bit of a tech hub. It's a lot cheaper than Silicon Valley to set up an office there, and just a lot easier as well. So, that's been really successful. And then we have satellite offices in San Fran and Chicago as well. And now also developing an office in Toronto in Canada. So that's kind of our presence in the US and Canada.
Many international tech companies that start to focus on the US by default think, well, we need to be in Silicon Valley, and they go to Silicon Valley first. You didn't do that. Is there a specific reason for that?
There is, and that's a good question. Yeah. So the reason, Boston is the second largest tech hub to Silicon Valley, but Boston's also a really good place to be if you want an international business because it's 5 hours from London. And obviously closer to the middle of the world, if you like. So we've always wanted to be a global business. And Silicon Valley is a bit out the way. It's probably a little bit like Australia from that perspective. So time zone challenges. It's also incredibly expensive to set up business there. So I think the location to our London office, which I was going to get back to, which is still where our developers sit. So it's an interesting place to develop software. It's probably one of the most expensive places. I guess if we had it all over again, we might have considered having a bigger dev set up in South Africa, for example. But we've got a very international development team. So, a lot of folk from the Eastern Bloc, from India and so on. So it's not just, English folk. And we've relocated them from their country. So it's a very international group. And a very large group now. So we must have circa 200 software developers in the UK. We are starting to build a bit of a development capability in the US as well. So we kind of split up between London and the US. So, Boston, particularly from a head office perspective. So Neil Murray, who's one co-founder and CTO, he's still based in London, and he's got a family there. Peter Bauer actually moved across to Boston, along with our CFO. So our CEO, CFO, CMO, which is Chief Marketing Officer, and Chief Operations Officer, all sit in Boston. But our official domicile is still the UK.
Okay.
We're now listed on NASDAQ as well. But again, so our official domicile is still London. But for all intents, our head office, other than our dev capability, is now in the US. We've also subsequently, just this year, opened up an office in Germany. That's a very large market. I was actually quite surprised to see how much larger it is than the UK. I suspected they were fairly equivalent, but it's probably about 60% bigger economy than the UK. So that represents a really large opportunity for us. So we've set up an office in Munich, and we're really starting to now focus on building out a European business. Also, when we set up new offices, which we kind of call franchises, if you like, there are two models. The one is with data center investment, and the other is without. Certain countries are very holy about sovereignty and data sovereignty and so on. And for them, they really insist that you have a data center in the country. But not all countries are that demanding, because they also realize that software businesses can't afford to put data centers in every country that they operate in. And if smaller countries, if you like, want to leverage the benefits of software as a service, providing obviously that we can prove that it's secure and so on, and the benefits being simplicity, lower costs, predictability, instant functionality, quick development cycles, no sort of people over and hardware and software overhead in terms of a solution, then they've just got to leverage the internet. So some of our new office environments don't have data centers and some do. Australia is the other fairly new business. I think it's about 4 years officially. We unofficially used to run it from here, and we did that for a few years, picked up a few customers here and there. As you know, there's quite a lot of business relationship between Australia and South Africa, particularly around mining, so we've picked up quite a few customers there, legal as well. We've now officially got an office there, and we've also got data centers there. We then have another office in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, and also in the Nordics, which is a satellite office, if you like, or satellite offices, and they don't have data centers. And then we've set up an office, so part of my team, in Dubai, and there we don't have data centers either. One of the reasons for not having data centers in that region is all of the countries there are very sovereign. So if you had a data center in Dubai, you almost would be penalized by not getting business in some of the neighboring countries like Oman, Qatar, right, Bahrain, etc. So we've kind of just wanted to stay neutral there and just check things out. And Dubai is also actually quite a small economy. So it's a rich economy, but in terms of email users, which is how we size the market, it's still quite small. So by way of example, there are probably 4.5 million email users in South Africa, plus minus, and in Dubai there's under 700,000. So,
wow.
South Africa still represents a large market for us. But Dubai is a gateway to other regions, and we're picking up business, in Northern Africa, bits and pieces in India, and then the surrounding sort of oil countries like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a very big market. Also, I was quite surprised by the size of that market and economy, but there are about 75 million people there.
Yeah.
And millions of email addresses. Obviously, we have cultural challenges there that we have to try and overcome. So as we grow out our business in Dubai, we'll look to bring on some Arab-speaking folk to help us, bridge some of the cultural differences in that market. So it's a very interesting market. So, there's a lot of, it's very cosmopolitan, but it's almost, quite segmented between, Arab influence, Indian influence, and then expat influence, if you like. So it makes for quite an interesting business challenge. And it's quite, I guess, challenging to apply your first world cadence, if you like, to a quite a developing third world but yet rich economy. And that's a big challenge as a listed business, because and probably the biggest difference since listing, and we picked that up in our last conversation, is that it just everything becomes more rigorous. So, you know, it's monthly forecasting, monthly numbers, you know, a lot more deeper understanding of the levers in your business. So a lot of business analysis, which is very useful. But as you start, understanding more about your business, you start realizing where you can invest more, and that perhaps there's a whole new opportunity that you haven't really seen before. So as we get deeper and deeper into understanding our business, we start stretching ourselves more and more in terms of our numbers and our growth. And that's why we've had such good growth, as well as, I guess, cybersecurity just being such a hot topic.
Let's talk a little bit about that listing, because it was late 2015 that you came to the market. Mm. Why did you decide to list in the first place? And secondly, why did you choose to list on the NASDAQ specifically, especially given that you were a London domiciled company?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I guess, you know, Peter would probably be the best person to answer that. But, you know, we're very close business, and we talk to each other all the time. And based on the information I've been privy to, I guess, again, it's the whole, you know, NASDAQ is the big platform, and, and it's a brave, bold business. So, albeit it's a business that has, as you know, been pretty under the radar, and it's a humble business. It's always been very aspirational, and we believe that we have a company and also a product set that can play on the biggest stage. So it was really just around being on the biggest stage, but also America is the biggest market by far. And it's also becoming, and even in 2015, by far our biggest market. So it's kind of logical, I guess, to have your listing in your biggest market, where the biggest opportunity resides, I guess. And the reason for listing, you know, probably a couple, but I guess we felt that we were at the stage and size where, and opportunity, we're a listing where you can raise, and we raised circa $100 million, just under, you know, it just gives you access to capital to really take advantage of the opportunity that presents itself. I mean, albeit, you know, we're a pretty decent-sized business, we're still minuscule in relation to the size of the opportunity. So, you know, if you're growing nicely, and growing in our business is expensive, so, you know, going into new regions and big sales forces and big marketing budgets and those types of things, you need capital. And I guess that's the opportunity where you can raise the most capital. But then you've also got to be able to stand up to the rigors of being a public company. And we started, you know, and it's been interesting for me, because when I first started in the business, having been at Dimension Data, I was used to like a rigorous listed company. And then coming to Mimecast, you know, everything was a lot looser and just very entrepreneurial. But it was interesting to watch the evolution over the years. And a lot of your growing up, if you like, happens when you get funding. So the first round of VC funding, we needed to grow up a bit and stand up some decent financials. And then the next set of funding, grow up a little bit more. And then listing, grow up entirely. And you know what it's like. I mean, being a listed company, you can fall hard too. So, fortunately, you know, we've had a very successful listing.
I was looking at the share price performance since listing this morning. In fact, it's almost been an straight upward graph.
Yeah, not quite, but overall, yes. So we listed at $10, which we were a bit disappointed about, because we felt the business was worth more. So, you know, we were looking forward to some instant gratification through an upward trend, which didn't happen, funnily enough. And the business slumped from a $10 share price to $6, okay, which is very concerning. And from six, it's very consistently, without any major spikes, which is ultimately where you want to be. I'll get back to that. we went from $6 to $32 in the space of about 17 months or so.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and it's pulled back slightly to about $28. But it had had a good run, and the whole market's just pulled back a little bit from a tech stock perspective. And what's very interesting is if providing you can do what you say you're going to do, which is what a listing's all about, you know, you give guidance and then and deliver on that guidance, you get rewarded. Conversely, if you don't, you get penalized. And we've been rewarded nicely, and we've sort of beaten raised as we've gone through each of our quarters. So it's been very successful, but you know, beating and raising in perpetuity is
tough.
Is tough. So it just becomes more and more rigorous, more and more demanding. So, and at the same time, you want to build a culture where people, you know, love working here and they've got a real purpose. But at the same time, how you got to perform, because ultimately, you know, we're a public-facing company, and we've got, you know, many more stakeholders than just the team here that try and deliver results. So yeah, it's been good. I believe actually the most successful security listing over the last 2 years, which we're very proud of. But these things are dynamic, and you've just got to, I guess, make sure that you can keep it going.
When I was looking at the numbers, you've got a market cap somewhere around 1.5, 1.6 billion US dollars at the moment. If you translate that into Rand and assume you were listed on the JSE, you'd be the biggest IT company on the JSE today.
Yeah, that's right. Fascinating. I think we're about 2.2 times the market cap of an EOH, for example. It's quite interesting considering we only 1,000, just touched 1,000 people. So the business, I guess, is considered very valuable. Obviously, the global footprint is, you know, is a big part of that value. Every region that we've been to, which typically English-speaking sort of economies, other than now our sojourn into Europe, we've been successful. So our formula, I guess, and it is a very formulaic business, and the problem we're solving is universal and pervasive. So you kind of, if you can build a formula, you can really go anywhere. It's just also about timing and getting the timing right, because you'll just like our competitors wouldn't come to South Africa because of our sort of dominant, well, they wouldn't invest largely in trying to, I guess, take a big portion of this market, because we've been in this market for so long and we've got so strong. By the same token, we've got to try go to markets that we feel we can be successful fairly quickly. And that's not every market. So, you know, can we take the Mimecast culture and formula and put that into Brazil? I don't know, but it just sounds like it could be a little bit risky. Can we do that in Australia? Yes. Can we do that in Asia? Yes. You know, in places like Singapore, for example. So you just got to choose the right markets. And because the runway is so long, as mentioned, and the market size is big and the opportunity is big, you also want to go to markets that are typically big and offer a really good, sustainable runway. And that is probably counterintuitive to us opening up in Dubai, but I'll just explain that because I see you were interested in that particular question. But each of the regions, if you like, and that's the US, Europe, which is UK and Europe, we just refer to it now as Europe, Africa and Middle East, which is our business, and Australia, or APAC, if you like, though they are only in Australia at this point in time, but the intention is to grow into New Zealand, which is a pretty small economy, and then up eventually into Asia, probably through via Singapore. But each of those regions, if you like, has a long-term growth trajectory and business plan. And we feel in this particular market that we needed to extend out of South Africa to retain that growth trajectory. Also, obviously, with the, I guess, challenges of South Africa and the currency, because we're reporting in US dollars, you know, we wanted some strength in other markets and growth opportunities in other markets. So We've chosen to grow into Kenya, in Nairobi, and then Dubai in the Middle East. And both of them, we feel, after doing a lot of investigation, are probably the easier places to set up business in the region that I'm responsible for. So we decided not to, for example, put an office and an investment down in Nigeria just yet, because if we compared how we do business and I guess the maturity of the market and the internet, which is very important in cloud computing, we felt that Kenya would be the best option in Africa, and also probably a better cultural match in terms of how they do business with us. And then Dubai is the gateway to the Middle East. So they were logical decisions, albeit that they aren't two particularly large economies. Mm. But Kenya, you can service Tanzania and Uganda and some neighboring countries there, and obviously with Dubai, Saudi Arabia, and so on. So we're not specifically going into those countries per se just to service those countries. It's more regions, if you like, which is, it's kind of the only way we feel we'll have a sustained trajectory for the next 3 to 5 years.
Do you work through partners in some of these markets, or do you put your own staff on the ground every time?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'll answer in two ways. In this business, so the Middle East and Africa business, we only trade through partners. So we're 100% partner-focused business. The same in Australia, the same in the UK. The US still do a lot of direct business. And it's just the way that market is. So customers buy directly from the vendor. We are building a partner ecosystem there, but they're also still in that kind of evolution phase. So we used to be, the first few customers that you bring on, you always really sign them directly and handhold them through the process. And then you evolve, and I think it was in May 2012, so some 8 years into our business and some 5 years ago, we pivoted to a partner only model in this market, and it's worked really well for us, and the partner ecosystem like it, obviously, because they know that the vendor's never competing with them. So when we go into Kenya and Dubai, the same. So it's only via partners. We have an office in Dubai, so with pretty much a go-to-market team, if you like. So we have marketing capability, we have business development capability, we have sales guys, account manager, partner manager. So it's really around a go-to-market team, if you like, and as well as customer experience, which is really important. We'll talk a bit about that. In Kenya, we're still traveling. So we go there every second week. We've got two folk that work that market. Just starting to break through, I'm pleased to say, until the elections have come up there as well. So there's some political turmoil, and that's delayed a lot of our transactions. So we're hoping to pick that up in January. But at a point in time where we feel we've got enough penetration and mindshare, we'll put an office down there. It's just, as you start getting momentum, the kind of expectation is that you're around more. So we do still sell through partners. But one of the challenges with Mimecast, and I think selling any service where you're dealing with businesses' information, is that it's typically high touch. So I would still say in the South African or Middle Eastern African business, 90% of the transactions that we do have Mimecast involvement. Which is a little bit unfortunate for a very aspirational growth business, because you want to get that scale that partners could give you, but it just is a high touch business. And we've probably also been our worst enemies in that we like to control the sales process, because we just it's all we do. It's essentially one platform, and a partner might be selling 10 or 20 or 30 different products. So the depth of their understanding of the problems that they're trying to solve and the solutions they're going to put together is not nearly as deep as what ours is. And then I guess partners also like to have us in the cycle because of that very fact. So, it's a meaningful, deep engagement with their customers and normally quite a fruitful one. It's a big problem we're solving. It's companies' reputations and money and all of those things are at stake now with cyber crime and the various flavors of cyber attacks that are happening.
I want to talk a bit about cybersecurity a bit later in the discussion, but the market that you play in has changed quite dramatically over the last 10 years. It's become a lot more competitive. We see big players getting into the space. Microsoft obviously has always been a player in the email market, but it's recently launched online exchange. Office 365 is making a huge push into the cloud space. There's Google, there are others. Where is Mimecast positioned relative to those big US tech giants who are increasingly muscling into the online email market?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. And it's different in the different regions that we operate. So let's talk about South Africa. So we got into this market early in 2004, as I mentioned. And we've built the business from the ground up. So along the way, of course, we've bumped into competition and so on. But I think where we've got a lot of strength in relation to, for example, a Symantec, is that Symantec has multiple product lines, and we just focus on email. So customers like that focus, and email is the threat vector of cyber attacks and so on. So it's the most high profile, if you like, of the threat areas around software. And so that, I guess, that focus and then subsequently also the investment we've put in has given us a competitive edge. So, you know, we're 110 people in South Africa whose focus purely is on a legendary customer experience. So we're able to service our customers better than any of our competitors, which has given us a big advantage. And, you know, some of our competitors here, as I mentioned, have got multiple different product lines and areas that they operate in. So we've managed to win the battle here. Microsoft is the interesting one. So, always a competitor, and, you know, Microsoft want a big piece of the customer's budget. And within that whole productivity suite of Office 365, which, by the way, is not just email, there is an email piece and there is an email security piece and there is some email storage. But our story really is that security needs to be layered. So much like your home, you know, you have potentially a guard if you're in a clustered estate or something like that. You've got your wiring, you've got your alarm, etc., etc. To ultimately be safe, a layered approach is better than just a single kind of protection, if you like. So, and customers buy into that, you know. And Office 365 also, while being a great product, you know, if it goes down, it's down, and it's not, you know. So we offer a service where, if it is bumpy or up and down, you can seamlessly still interact and engage via email through the Mimecast Continuity Service. So we augment Office 365 really well in two ways. So from a continuity perspective and from a layered security approach. Also, I guess because of our focus, the depth of our security offering is superior to Microsoft. Having said that, their bank balance is way superior to ours, and if they really decided to invest in that, that would become more of a threat. The nice thing about being a single platform business, so we've only got a platform, and all of our services reside and iterate on that platform. We're very agile, so we can constantly bring new services to market based on the new and evolving threats. So we get there first very often, and by getting that first mover advantage, you can win the customer and then sell around that. Also, with Office 365 in particular, if you have a blended approach of Office 365 and Mimecast, you can potentially not have the most enterprise version of 365 or the most enterprise version of Mimecast. So, you know, you could buy a three-quarter version of 365 and a three-quarter version of Mimecast at a similar price to the enterprise of either, although you obviously have to have the platform being 365. So they're very efficient ways to procure it, and then to have that resilience of, you know, two clouds are better than one. You get that stronger, deeper, layered security as well. So, and we work very closely with Microsoft. So all of our plugins and all of that allow for a seamless user experience when using 365 and Mimecast together. Then just getting back to the original question around competition. So that's South Africa. Globally, there's some big businesses like Proofpoint, which is a listed email security and archiving business as well. They are the poster child, if you like, and we're just in their slipstream. They typically coming down market now from very large enterprise, and we coming up market, so from SME mid into enterprise, and that's where we're starting to compete. So the majority of our business is SME mid, the majority of their business is large enterprise. But similar service, although ours is a more out-and-out true SaaS platform where they have a combination of software and appliances and cloud versions and on-premise versions and so on. But they have a very strong competitor. And
they're American.
They're American, yeah, Silicon Valley. And they listed terminology, if you like, and size, they're a year ahead of us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and growing at similar growth rates. So we're kind of 1 year behind. So unless we accelerate our growth, they just kind of stay in front of us from a size perspective. Very interesting difference in the businesses. And if you look at the two businesses next to each other and success of IPO and the share price, and it's quite similar. We more tend to track them than them tracking us. So we were quite fortunate, I guess, to get into the listing at the time when Proofpoint was doing so well and kind of get into their slipstream and mirror their growth rates and success.
Might it make sense at some point for those two businesses to merge? I don't know if you can comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, all those kinds of conversations do take place. I think fundamentally, though, and this is the point I was also going to make earlier, we're a SaaS platform, mm-hmm. And they're a combination of on-prem appliance, software as a service, cloud, etc. And they're also an acquisitive business, so they've bought businesses and products and so on, and then integrated them. So fundamentally, the platforms are very different, and I guess that's where the challenge comes in any sort of acquisition or merger. But in terms of adding the two businesses together, you'd obviously have a really big, strong player. A couple of businesses also have got out of the email space. So McAfee, for example, just last year, they're a big, strong security business. They decided to exit the email and email security space. Another one was Postini, which was acquired by Google. So what that's done is provide a lot of good runway for Mimecast and Proofpoint and Symantec, I guess, which is great. But I guess what it also shows is that some businesses don't feel that they can make money in email, or didn't at the time. So that's interesting, because we feel we can, but you've obviously got to have a very, very efficient product roadmap, and also your ability to build software at the right sort of cost to be able to make money out of this piece. And I guess also some of the businesses probably looked at where Microsoft were going and just didn't want to, have that fight. I'd say, Proofpoint would be the biggest, and email would be the next, Symantec probably third. We also get the impression that through some of the corporate movement with Symantec, that they're less focused on email now than they were. So that's also providing us runway, because they were at one point in time quite a brutal competitor. They bought a business called Live Office, which was quite similar to Mimecast about 5 or 6 years ago. And they also bought a business called Message Labs about 7 or 8 years ago or so, which also similar to Mimecast. And then they've kind of integrated those two products together. They then had the split with Veritas, so they parted again. So they've had some challenges with how they fit, I guess, the email storage and email security businesses together, which gives us an advantage because, you know, most of our customers store email and we protect their email. With Symantec now, it sits in two different businesses. And that compromised them in this market as well and gave us some more opportunity.
Mm. Let's come back and talk a bit about cybersecurity. It's been a pretty torrid year in that space in South Africa, certainly with things like the Jigsaw database leak and the hack at Hetzner and other incidents. But specifically in the email space, what are the threats, what are the emerging trends that you've seen in this through this year?
Okay, so initially, and that's not this year, going back in time, the major threats were spam and viruses, obviously. And so you had an anti-spam and an antivirus service. Kind of, if you just want a ticket to the game now, you've got to tick those boxes. So you just have to have a very robust service around spam protection and management, the same with viruses. The emerging threats are targeted threats, are called targeted threats. So we've built a suite of products called Targeted Threat Protection. And within that, the major threats are, URL compromises, attachments, weaponized attachments and ransomware, and then impersonation. What we're seeing is certainly the most prolific of those. Well, initially, I guess URL was the big one, but it's pivoted towards impersonation and ransomware as being the two major kind of threat areas. You would have seen those some of those compromises like WannaCry, Petya, Bad Rabbit, etc., which largely are ransomware. But we're seeing a lot of impersonation. And impersonation really is around, cyber criminals trying to access predominantly information or get payments to be made. So it's really, access to money. And that we're seeing as certainly a rising threat. And we've seen, in our customer bases, which obviously is confidential information, but we've seen some quite large compromises as far as money is concerned, and these are kept pretty discreet because businesses want to protect their reputations. Mm. So while I guess there's an obligation for the media to get the news out there, which they're doing really well, there's a lot of news that's also not getting out there. So what we're seeing is businesses that we've been talking to around our Target Threat Protection suite, they struggle sometimes to get the approval at board level because this is quite new concepts and, directors and boards are possibly not as well informed as the folk that run the IT systems and so on. So it's sometimes quite a battle to get the funding to procure these protective services. But then just suddenly out of the blue, we'll get, you guys need to come in now and...
Because
something's happened. So you're running your pipeline and all of a sudden, or one of these large pervasive threats and then the buying cycles happen quickly. So the product might appear to be expensive, which it's not. But in relation to the compromises that we're seeing from a financial perspective, can pay itself back many, many times over. But what businesses can't get back is their reputations. And that's, I think, even more of a threat than money. You can make the money back over time, but reputation is difficult. I mean, just some of the stuff we were talking about earlier and of large listed companies. I mean, it's a long road back after that kind of thing can happen. The other threat that's emerging, which is an interesting one, and we're very fast to market here as well, is the insider email protection, if you like. So 99% of organizations that we've surveyed have been impacted by sort of internal threats. And those relate to, malicious insiders, for example, or people sending information that they shouldn't be, or just sending information erroneously. So we have the ability to scan attachments and URLs as well as content inspections via DLP services. So kind of offering the same kind of services that we would at the perimeter with outside organizations internally as well.
How do you know what to look for, though? How do you get software to determine whether something is shouldn't be there or not?
Yeah, so essentially how Mimecast is built is it's a set of policy engines for functionality and databases for storage at a very, very high level. And we, being in the business that we do, we build up a lot of threat intelligence. And we have some 30,000 businesses using our service now. So the globally. So we have a whole team within our software development team that are, you know, building up a huge database of intelligence. And we're able to, how we, I guess, monitor an organization's email to pick up those kinds of emerging threats, and then to develop policies which protect or manage those types of threats. So a user that has a Mimecast service, I mean, there would be some, you know, I don't know, it's about 500 policies, which in turn is, you know, 500 pieces of functionality, if you like. And it's all policy driven in terms of the functionality and services that you want to deliver back into your business. So I guess there are various ways that you can configure for the various types of protection that you're looking for. So businesses might also suspect that there's certain types of patterns within their organization, and then we set up the policies to be able to monitor that type of behavior.
And what about things like machine learning and artificial intelligence? Can you apply those technologies to this to pick up new threats before your teams, your analysts even have a chance to, I mean, can computers themselves start to detect these emerging threats before the humans are aware of them?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So one of the 2018 industry predictions in our space is the game-changing effect that artificial intelligence will have on cybersecurity. So it's likely that we'll see a rise in the use of AI or machine learning to introduce attacks that can morph more quickly. So this is all a new space, but you can just imagine that, I guess, the intelligence and breadth of AI getting into the space could represent some major challenges for business.
Because the attackers could use AI as well.
Exactly.
So, I mean, where is this going? Eventually, are we going to have machine fighting machine?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It could be like that. In fact, one of our colleagues was doing a presentation yesterday. We have this internal TED Talk type program, and it was a fascinating TED Talk that he did around comparing his 2-year-old boy and his next 30 years to, you know, what, 30 years from now, to 2045 or so,
yeah.
So just under 30 years, in relation to how AI is going to develop over that time. And there's major deltas of opinion on this. So, for example, Elon Musk is vehemently against AI and machine learning. Interestingly, being such a great tech leader, and then there are others that believe it's just going to be incredible. And then in the middle, I think is where, for example, Microsoft and Satya Nadella are, and I feel that's kind of the right place, and that is that AIs could have a really positive effect in terms of the development of people in business, and it's worth embracing it rather than trying to fight it, because it's got a lot of momentum already. So in other words, how can we use AI to be better and to build better economies and to educate people better and develop people better? But it's certainly going to have an impact on cybersecurity, and I think that's going to start this year.
Before we wrap up, Brandon, The email is one of the oldest technologies around. If I'm not mistaken, it might even predate the internet. It's the bane of many people's lives as well. But it doesn't seem to be going away, even in the era of instant messaging. Certainly you talk to millennials today and they'll tell you that they don't use email. They use WhatsApp or Snapchat or whatever it is that they communicate on these instant messaging platforms. But certainly in business, email seems to be there to stay. But what's its future? If anything, it's become more and more burdensome for companies. There's a lot more regulation around the storage and archiving of email. What does this market look like in 10, 20 years from now? Are we still going to be using Outlook and are we still going to be running big corporate email systems, or are we going to progress onto something else?
Yeah, so I don't know, but what we can certainly see is that and we watch this carefully, obviously, you know, because this is our business, and we're well aware of the onerous nature of email and the regulations and all that. What we're really trying to do is make email safer and easier for business. So we acknowledge that challenge, and we're trying to address it. But when we kind of monitor our customers' email trends and so on, they certainly are not sending less email. I know personally within our business and how we engage with our customers, we're sending more email. So it's certainly not going anywhere for now. And it's so embedded in business in general. Like, I mean, people engage with email, you know. I mean, if I look at our business, for example, and you walk around, I'd say at least half the day most people are stuck in their email, and it really is a pervasive.
It's almost associated with work.
Exactly. And you'd find a lot of people actually go to work and they might be working on a business application, but alongside email, and that's what they work on the entire day. So, and it's also, it's kind of ingrained into most business applications as well. So, it's just part of the flow of business. And, you know, the two biggest email providers in the world today by far are Microsoft and Google. And they refer to email really as, Office 365 and I guess Google Apps as productivity tools. So what they're trying to do is to build a lot of productivity into their suite of products, of which email is one of those tools. So I guess in their product suites, you can see how folk are starting to use other products to communicate, if you like. So, you know, your links and your Skypes and all of that, but within a productivity suite. So, and I guess one of the reasons for that is, you know, the spoken word is always more productive than the written word. The written word doesn't have any, I mean, one of the challenges is it doesn't have interpretation in it. So, you know, and tone and all of those important things. So I think what businesses are trying to do is get people, firstly, to speak more face-to-face, so video communication. If not video, then voice communication, with tone and interpretation and relationship and all of that can be strong, and that's important in business. But also, obviously, email, because, you know, it's a very good tool in terms of being able to record information and transactions as well. And, you know, with all the regulation that you speak about, that's very important too. So, for example, if we only communicated via voice, I don't know how you would find a conversation that we had 5 years ago on a certain topic and how easy that would be. Whereas with email, it's very easy. So, you know, and things like contracts and all of that are all saved and stored and I guess processed in the email environment. And that's really, I guess, the fundamental of how business is done. So if you start a business relationship, you have a contract. If you trade, you have a contract. And email's kind of the platform where a lot of that kind of engagement happens.
I suppose, as the Guptas have discovered to their horror.
Absolutely. You know, and interestingly, in every single court case, just about.
Yeah.
Email is referred.
Yeah.
So, and that's a great example that you bring up. It's because the, I guess, of the authenticity also of the records.
Mm.
And in our email, the way we store email, it's tamper-proof. So it's so strong as an artifact in a contract or in a legal engagement. And I guess that also will ensure that email has a good future. So I think to cut quite a long story short there, it's certainly going to, I think the aim is that it becomes more of a collaboration productivity tool, but it's here to stay, you know, certainly in the foreseeable future. But what businesses certainly don't want is that it continues to grow at the rate that it has, because it's just become, like you
unwieldy.
Say, that's a great word. And onerous and regulation, and it's become quite a sticky, I guess, tool that's growing as well. So it's become, like, I guess, an overhead and unwieldy tool for business.
What's happened with spam? I remember seeing some figures a couple of years ago about how the percentage of all emails being spam had risen to some ridiculous level, like 70 or 80% or higher. Is that still the case? Is it getting worse?
Yeah. What the immediate trends are, but it's still absolutely. I mean, we're just looking at a customer currently now where we saw some reports, and they had a bit of a spam problem. So they had a really rudimentary service in there. And so we put them on a trial service, and we blocked some 70% of the emails that were coming into their organization via our service. So so from them going, and we put our service on top of the service that they were running currently. So by adding an additional layer like Mimecast, we cut out 70% of the email. And the CIO there was delighted, because kind of the bandwidth saving that he was making in their business could, you know, count for a large portion of the budget required to procure Mimecast. So
it
almost made it a very easy business decision.
Great. Well, Brandon, this has been a great discussion. I'm going to be adding Mimecast to my watch list. I'm going to be watching that share price with some interest. I didn't realize how much it had actually run up since the listing. I hadn't looked since the last time we spoke in early 2016, I think it was.
Yeah.
So Brandon Becker is MD for Mimecast in the Middle East and Africa. Thanks so much for talking to Tech Central today.
Thanks very much, Duncan. Appreciate it.